Hello and a very warm welcome to Political Economy with Shweta Punj. We are in the middle of election season. India is currently voting for its new government. It's in the process of voting for its new government, and the next phase of voting is on the 26th of April. Now, the big question, what determines the votes of Indians? How do Indians decide which party do they want to vote for? There has been enough debate and discussion around whether it's the economic issues that dominate the minds of voters, or is it issues like caste, religion, and so on. Well, expectedly, political rhetoric around elections is reaching a new crescendo every day. But like always, we will get you the facts, we will get you complete analysis which is based on numbers, on data. Now, to understand how India votes, I have with me today a veteran sociologist, Dr. Surjeet Bhalla, an economist who has just recently written this book, How We Vote. And we're delighted to have Dr. Bhalla with us. Dr. Bhalla, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations for completing this book in record time. You mentioned that you worked on it for about 4 to 5 months. It's very rich in data, and you've put down, I think, your over 4 decades of experience in analyzing elections right here in this book. So I would recommend anybody who's interested in understanding India's political landscape, India's economic landscape, should read this book. It's full of insights, Dr. Bhalla. The title of your book, How We Vote, is very intriguing because as I said, that it is one of those questions which really does not have, there is no one right answer to that question. So I want to begin by asking you, in this book, you talk about the challenge of narratives. And at the moment, as an economic journalist, you know, there's one clear challenge that I face as a reporter, and I can imagine what a challenge it must be for people to really get a true sense of what's happening with the Indian economy. You know, you'll see corporate balance sheets, and you'll see an optimistic picture of the Indian economy. You speak with global experts, and they'll say this is India's moment. And then you'll have a survey that'll point out that okay, all is not well, and there's certain areas of economy that are under stress. Whether it's poverty reduction data, there's controversy around that. Whether it's growth data, there's controversy around that. Since when did data become so controversial? And why is it that the Indian voter is being pulled into multiple directions and into multiple narratives? Why is it so difficult for us to get an accurate sense of what's happening in the Indian economy?
I think for journalists and for experts, it's difficult to get an accurate sense. I don't think for the voter, and that's what we find, it is at all difficult to know what is going on. They have experienced whatever it is that they think affects their voting behavior. And in this regard, you know, I cite President Clinton in his campaign in 1992, and that's the last line in the book as well. Is the economy stupid? Now, to really dissect, you know, basically, what do you think? I'm using it as a generic view. What makes us vote for one person or one party or another? Now, it has to do with how we feel that person or that party will help my individual welfare. So, obviously, I'm concerned with everybody else's welfare. But the number one concern, I mean, this was written up by Adam Smith, that the number one concern is, what have you done for me lately, or how has my income, expenditure, welfare changed over the last 5 years, let's say the preceding election period. So that's number one. Number two is, what is going on in the mind of the voter is, how will the opposition, if they came to power, how they will affect my welfare. So everything is geared towards my welfare. It's not being selfish. It's not being not caring for other people. This is human behavior, human psychology. You want to have that person in power. That is, now welfare includes many, can include many aspects and does include many aspects. But the dominant aspect is economic. So the dominant utility is economic. So I want to vote for the person who will most improve my economic well-being. And, you know, there have been surveys done on happiness index and so on and so forth. And all of them find that it's highly correlated with your income. So,
is this unique to India, Dr. Bhalla, voting on the economy across?
One thing I would say, and you know, I started writing back in the 80s on the that Indians in particular, but maybe it's also near universal, think they're unique. And I always point out, scratch yourself and there'll be red blood. And there are 7.5 billion people in the world with red blood. So it is, nothing is unique to India. Everything is the same, no matter where you are. At least that's the overarching principle through which an economist and I analyze events, etc. Then there are special cases. So
that brings, you know, so you've gone through the Nehru years, you've done an analysis on the Vajpayee years as well. So if the question is on the economy, and that's what the voters are voting on, what happened in the 2004 election, the India Shining campaign? Where was the disconnect there?
Okay. Look, I think that was one of the elections we got wrong. But, you know, so it's important to point out to the voters or to the audience that based on just how well you've done in your income, how GDP has grown, that a simple metric, did GDP per capita grow by more than 3.25%, you vote for the incumbent. And if it's less than 3.25%, you vote against the incumbent. Now that's about the simplest metric. Now 3.25% per capita in the olden days used to be 5+% GDP growth, right? Because the population growth was 2%. So this very simple metric is able to explain 10 out of the last 14 elections after excluding 52, 57. And obviously one can't explain 52, one can't explain 57, 62. We were just born as a democracy, etc. So I think now to your specific question of what went wrong in 2004, it was, you know, clearly the BJP thought that they would win, and you know, were, and when you look at the data, it turns out that one, they lost the coalition. Remember, they only got, they lost by about 15 seats relative. It was a coalition era. So Tamil Nadu was a big, big factor in there. And the other point we make in the book is that if you look at the margins in 99 and 2004 versus margins in 2019 and 14, that now the BJP has a large cushion. So I've seen this argument being made. Look, the BJP lost in 2004. They thought they were going to win. Now, did they have a substantive case? If Tamil Nadu had not gone with the DMK, had not gone with the opposition, the, you know, BJP would have won, or Vajpayee would
Tamil
have
Nadu.
Won.
Yeah.
In Tamil Nadu. So what state? Then there are other factors, but you know, other factors that we looked at is the turnout and so on and so forth. But I think the dominant one, it was a coalition era. There was no prospect. They were not saying they would get a majority. And, you know, 39 seats, when you 180 seats or so, then that can make a big difference. So
interesting.
I think the comparison with 2004 is a bit stretched.
Okay.
And as I point out, that suits the narrative of the opposition. They say, look, this happened in 2004. It's going to happen again. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the evidence? If you
sure. So I want to come back to the point of feeling of well-being, which, you know, the personal mm-hmm. feeling of that I'm taken care of, I have the right opportunities and so on. So anecdotally, when you speak to people, when you speak to young people, you get a sense that, so there are two narratives emerging from there. One is a lot of young people are very, very, you know, influenced by this whole idea of be job creators and so on. In fact, I was in a conversation with, Sanjay G of CSDS, and he said the same thing. He said that while employment is a concern, this whole narrative of becoming a job creator is finding a lot of resonance amongst Indians, young Indians. On the other hand, you also come across, data, and you come across instances when you see 3 lakh, 4 lakh people have applied for a government job and for maybe 100 positions, say in the Indian Railways or wherever. So those stories are also coming out. So what is the sense that, Dr. Bala, what is your analysis showing on the employment aspect of it? I want to touch upon three things. One, on poverty reduction. Again, that data is also being questioned. There is one set of data. There's one set of interpretation which shows that.
First, on because there's a large set of issues. Just because the data is questioned, you and I and all of us have a responsibility to whether the questioning of the data is substantive or not. Okay.
Fair enough.
But let me go back to the jobs, because I think that's a very important.
Yeah.
Now, I have always believed in all my research, etc., that the level of any indicator is not important for elections. It's the change. Remember what we started off this conversation.
Yeah.
How have things changed for me?
Right.
So now let's look at the employment data without going into levels. That right now, youth unemployment, etc., is at the lowest levels in the last 15 years and lower than in 2019. So in other words, there's a big improvement. Unemployment rate is still high for the youth. Mm-hmm. Absolutely no question. But it is a lot lower now than at the time of the previous election. So that's number one. Then we come to, oh my God, 5,000 people applying for a job, etc. 2 million people applying for a job. Now, this is something which I've written about, etc. We should all be concerned. What's going on? One other thing on jobs and unemployment. After the age of 30, the unemployment rate in India, age of 29, so 30 and above, the unemployment rate in India is about 1.5%. Has been for a long time. So what is going on?
Okay. Right.
That look, the government, all of these jobs that you're telling me, 20 million applying for 5 jobs and all the rest of the propaganda, all perhaps correct.
Right.
What's a person supposed to do? The government gives you a very cushy job. There's pension. You may be not required to work as hard. You're not going to be fired. I will apply for a job, government job. I mean, you name me any job anywhere in the world as cushy as an Indian government job.
That's true. And the benefits that come with it and the salaries.
Yeah. So, and women get 2 years of childcare leave or whatever, maternity leave. And many of those things may be good, but all I'm saying is that's not evidence of anything. I know prominent friends of mine, prominent economists keep mentioning this. Oh my God, there were 5,000 people who applied for one clerk's job. Give me a break. Second, what we have to recognize, and this is a phenomenon around the world, and it's in my book, The New Wealth of Nations. if you are a college degree holder today,
anywhere
in the world, including the US,
right?
Okay, your rate of growth
of
income, or even the level, is not very good compared to non-college graduates. So what happened? What happened in the world, and I plead guilty, so does everybody else, we all believed, and correctly so, that education was the path to success. I benefited a lot from education, etc. College education, I'm talking about, not just. So we all said, and around the world, the World Bank went, and the IMF, and everybody, you know, go ahead, go forth and educate. And not just educate, basic, college. So there is a huge surplus. I'll give you one statistic which is there in my book in 2017, The New Wealth of Nations. In 1993, the total amount of college graduates in the Western world was about, per year, was 50 million.
Okay.
The total amount of college graduates, new flow, in 1993 was also 50 million in the rest of the world. Today, the Western world has gone from 50 million per year to 60 million per year. The rest of the world has gone from 50 million to 300 million per year. So, and this is before we add Zoom and everything else, that you can be sitting anywhere in the world, hiring whoever is there anywhere in the world. So I feel bad for the young generation. Okay, around the world, this is not the best time. The best time to be a college-educated young person was when I was growing up, which was a long, long time ago. So that's just a reality. So you look at China, you look at
the
US.
You're saying Western world, it's gone up from 50 to 60, and the rest of the world, it's gone up to 300.
300,
wow.
And these are both valid. Now you can say, oh my God, the, you know, degree, the quality of education is not so good, which is correct, as in the Western world and so on and so forth. But that held true in 93 as well.
Sure.
So the quality, first of all, has improved everywhere. Maybe in the rest of the world, it hasn't gone up as much. And I'm sure it is far below the Western level. But, you know, for hiring purposes, for most jobs, etc. No, this is a terrible time to be a youngster, terrible time, anywhere in the world, including India. So therefore, what does the data show? And I report in the book. If you look at non-college graduates, or casual workers, what I call casual, you look at salaried workers, which are basically college graduates, and you look at non-salaried workers, self-employed, as well as casual workers. The casual workers are basically the plumbers, the electricians, the people. Their wages, real wages, have grown at about 3 to 4 to 5% per annum for the last decade. The salaried workers, and especially looking through the tax data, has grown at about 1.5%. And if you don't look at the tax data, you look at the PLFS, it's flat. So this is a, as I said, it's definitely an Indian phenomenon, as well as a world phenomenon. It is to do with college education, which is a problem. And the latest data on the US has just come out that non-college graduates, for the first time in since 1980, that's 45 years, that their rate of growth is now higher than college graduates. So this is a, you know, and look at China, etc. They've got, they stopped publishing the data for youth.
So so you do list out some of the challenges for the Modi government going forward, and this harnessing India's demographic dividend so that it's not, it becomes a good thing to be young and not a burden to be young, will clearly you know, is one of the most pressing challenges.
Well, you know, I think the demographic dividend is one of the more misused phrases. What I'm saying is that it's not a good time to be a college graduate, but the demographic dividend has to do with how many people are there of working age and the growth of people in the working age, where in most of the world, it's negative rate of growth. There are of people of working age, 15 to 64, in most places in the world, it's negative. So in India, it's positive. So that's the demographic. We have more labor. You know, it used to be called dependency ratio and so on and so forth. We have more workers for non-workers. And one other statistic on that, but and I think I mentioned this in the book, I do, and a very important chart on which, I, you know, if I had my druthers, I would make that the number one chart. Look, the argument is made that we need first 20 million jobs a year. Okay. Yeah. And they say that, and Shashi Tharoor has made that accusation, etc. That PM Modi has said we need 20 million jobs a year. I just want to tell you how outlandish all of this is. Okay.
Okay.
And if you recall, in 2019 election, there was that Modi had promised in 2014 to 2019 that he will provide, or his government will provide, 10 million jobs a year. Okay. And in a report done for the PMEAC, we find no evidence of that quote anywhere. Okay. Just like there's no evidence for the quote of 20 million jobs a year. But to further illustrate how completely, patently absurd it is, the entire population, 15 to 64, that's called the working age population.
Right.
That is growing by no more than 10 million a year. So, bhai, 20 million kahan se karoge tum? So the population, which includes every woman, every man, everybody in that age group, whether working or not, that's the entire population that you have. So if you take what is now considered a very good aggregate labor force participation rate in the world, about 65%, that means that India only needs 6.5 million jobs a year. So
20 million is an inflated number.
You may not get the job. You may not get your government job. You may not get the best job in the world. You may not be the richest person in the world. But don't tell me that so I don't need any math to do this other than simple population. I don't need any economics is what I meant to do this. Yet you have prominent economists claiming, you know, my old friend Ashoka Modi claims that, and that's where I think the 20 million comes in. So Ashoka Modi in his book claimed that India needs 20 million jobs a year for the rest of this decade. So actually he said 200 million jobs over the decade. So what did the Congress party and its people do? So he said 200 million jobs over the decade. Okay, this is in his book, India's Broke. Divide that by 10, you get, lo and behold, 20 million jobs a year. And that becomes the Congress slogan. So, you know, basically this is narratives. This is, and the question we have to ask, since we are looking at elections, how many people buy this? That's the real import of this election. Do people buy these outlandish narratives?
So talking about outlandish narratives, in the last few weeks, we've heard a whole host of such narratives that are emerging on the direction that the Indian economy needs to take. We had Mr. Rahul Gandhi talk about a caste census. The slogan, Jitni Abadi Utna Haq, is something that he's been saying since his Padyatra 2 years ago that started from Kanyakumari. To talking about wealth redistribution, to Mr. Sam Pitroda talking about bringing in an inheritance tax as ways of bridging the inequality gap in India. I want to get in your thoughts on this, Dr. Bhalla. One on, because and you also have a chapter in your book called Redistributing Growth
with Redistribution.
growth with redistribution. So let's try and understand, you know, when Mr. Gandhi says that there needs to be a caste census and everybody should get the rights according in proportion to their population. That's what he's saying, jitni abadi utna haq. And Mr. Chakrabarty, one of the key members of the drafting committee of the manifesto, it has explained to me, is that when they speak about wealth redistribution, what they're essentially talking about is how do you look at wealth? Reservations is also wealth. So and that's already happening. Wealth redistribution is already happening. So just to try and get a sense of, you know, how are you viewing this narrative that's emerging, and what does it really imply for India?
Well, as I state in the book, and you know, all of the research that I've done, you need wealth to create wealth to redistribute wealth. So let's take the Congress. On the one hand, leading economists are saying there's no growth happening.
Yeah.
Right? The government is overstating growth. There's no growth happening. Hmm. And then you're going to redistribute what? So again, I agree with you. This is a stupid narrative. And you know, let's do the following. I think there are two ways one can look at it. One, that these guys actually believe what they are saying. The other is, if you think you've already lost the election, so you know you can't come up with any innovative ideas of the change that is needed, then you have to criticize the government for whatever it's claiming. So the government claims poverty is reduced. No, poverty is not reduced. The government is claiming inflation is low. No, it's actually quite high. The government is claiming that jobs are being created. No, jobs are not being created. So, and again, if it were true, we saw what happened in 2014. There was a lot of evidence, right? And people reacted to the evidence. I believe the same is going to happen now. So unless these guys are right.
And understand. So help us understand. So, yes, India is not the only country that's unequal. Inequality is a concern, and it's a concern everywhere. So, when we talk about wealth redistribution, I have tried to understand what Mr. Gandhi is implying through this wealth redistribution strategy. And from whatever I've understood is that we are already doing some of that. Right, the fact that we are funding the most expansive food distribution program is a form of wealth redistribution,
and the construction that, of houses, and
exactly, yeah. So, please.
I am arguing just the opposite in the book, that the Food Security Act, which was brought in 2013 by the previous government, said, 67% of the population should get free food. So the part of the reason that 800 million people are getting free food is because it's a law.
Right.
It's a law. The law says that 2/3 of the rural population and half of the urban population shall get free food. I mean, previously it used to be 1-2 rupees, so it's basically the same, right? What this government has done is really stop all leakages. So remember, for this very same Rahul Gandhi, his father came out with a very prophetic statement, not a prophetic, accurate statement. He said only 15 paise of every rupee goes to the poor from government programs. Yes. Remember, I hope he should read his own history.
Okay. Yeah.
And then several papers, some of them written by me, etc., concluded that Rajiv Gandhi was a wild-eyed optimist because the actual money that went to the poor was less than 15%. So basically, it was there a very convenient way, whether it's election financing. I wrote some articles that this is going to liquor manufacturers, the food is going, and there were shows that said the trucks are leaving for food ration shop to go to liquor. I mean, So government comes in, or new government comes in, Modi comes in, makes it a lot more efficient, effective, or targeted. Now 90% of the people who should be getting free food are getting free food, versus 15%, which Rajiv Gandhi himself said. It's not me saying.
Sure. So if you look at what's happening right now, we have free food, we have homes being made, we have Har Ghar Jal, we have RTE, you have midday meal schemes, plus complemented by other schemes, plus we have cash transfers.
Plus disability. I just know somebody who works for us that she is eligible to get 2,500 rupees a month as disability. Yeah. She doesn't have to work at a government job or anything. It's part of the disability package. That is why Mr. Modi has been winning, and that's why he's likely to win.
So wealth redistribution is already happening.
Big time, it's
already happening. Okay, now going on to the comment that Mr. Pitroda has made on introducing an inheritance tax and to bring in a more level playing field. When such narratives are introduced, you know, at a time like this, considering the mood in the Indian polity currently, considering the phase that the Indian economy is going through right now, do you think that something like this will work, will connect with the Indian voters? Does this actually hurt the Congress party more than it benefits them?
If pigs could fly, this would benefit the... I don't even have to think for a second to conclude it will not work. This is, you know, the elite mouthing off. I mean, it's sad. Back 30 years ago, I wrote this article that the slogan of the left, of the Congress party, of the liberals was Bismil Muflis. I begin in the name of the poor. So the biggest thing you could do, that was what Rajiv Gandhi was objecting to. You begin in the name of the poor. Same thing here with the, you tell me the difference between what Rajiv Gandhi said that the government was actually misdoing or badly doing, and what Mr. Pitroda and Rahul Gandhi are saying today, or the manifesto. I mean, what is this? So then these guys, now making a forecast, then these guys wonder why people don't vote for them.
So in your sense, this whole caste census narrative, it's not getting traction with the voters. India has moved on from that narrative.
Yes, again, the data narrative, if you look at the Bihar caste census, right? I mean, you know, the castes have been producing kids galore such that their share of the lower caste or whatever it is, or, you know, it just... I cry sometimes. I mean, why don't you just look at the data? And we do discuss the caste census in here. I mean, it's the worst idea to do a caste census. And there's good reason why we haven't done it since 1931. There was a caste census done in 2011, done by this very same opposition. Have you seen any of that being published? How do they explain? Why don't they first publish that data, which they commissioned, which came under them? So now suddenly they wake up one day and say, okay, we need a caste census.
So you were talking about the caste census, how that idea is not going to fly with the voters currently, and when the data shows that it does not work. That's the point that you were making.
What argument is this? The US has this. Therefore, we should have it. I mean, what is the basis for this? So just because the U.S. has it, the U.S. has various things that we don't want. So,
Okay. Let's go over your assessments that you make, your projections for the BJP. You have said that if the BJP vote share increases by 5%, then it would likely win 334 seats. And with a 7% increase, 347 seats. That's what you're projecting.
Yeah. So I stay by that. It's not an idle forecast. I mean, both Abhinav and I worked quite extensively at it. And I think a key variable to understand in there is how did we get it? And we explain it. That if you look at the state elections over the preceding, so from 2019 to 2024, and you look at for 2014 to 2019 and so on and so forth, the state elections, what the incumbent party gets, are a good predictor of what will happen in the national election. Now, it's not, we know that if in the state, and especially in the case of the BJP and Mr. Modi, that in the national elections, they vote for him more than they vote for him in the state elections, like in Karnataka, etc. So I'll just give you, I went on a trip to this to Karnataka, and in April, and what we found out, we interviewed various people. This is part of this election. I call them election junkies, not the limousine liberals, but the election junkies. And so it was clear that they would vote for Congress, and everybody who said they would vote for Congress. So we asked, I asked, etc., that look, okay, come national elections, who are you going to vote for? And 8 out of 10, at a minimum, said they'll vote for Mr. Modi. They did not mention BJP. They said they vote for Mr. Modi. So
is that happening? That's happened, that the BJP is now Mr. Modi. There is Mr. Modi has become this all-powerful, all-consuming political figure.
I think it's a mistake to say all-powerful, all-popular.
All-popular.
Yes. That they identify with him. And it's we go back to where we started. People have benefited. Poor people. I'm not talking upper-class people like Sam Patoda or you or me or whatever, right? I mean, people... they've seen their lives change in a positive direction enormously, such that they never saw it before. Look, explain to me the following. Sanitation is a very important component of
health,
let alone welfare. What did we do from 1948-47 to 2014, upper class people couldn't care less that there was no sanitation in the rural areas. It's a whole story about open defecation causing diseases, causing nutritional loss, and so on and so forth. We didn't care about it. Have you seen a single demonstration for 60 years? They didn't talk about it. And the same people are going to come and talk about wealth redistribution. I mean, get real. So I think one of the post the elections, I will say political parties should get real, go and smell whatever it is. And, I think it's a really big tragedy that every other country went and did two things. They went and did sanitation, and they went and did agricultural reforms.
Yeah.
Okay. 91, we had path-breaking reforms in India. Changed India's history. Absolutely.
Sure.
But what did they do on agriculture? Made it worse. Deformed further agriculture in 91 onwards. Okay. This whole MSP and et cetera, et cetera. We can go into detail. Then comes, in 2019-20, In the manifesto, Congress manifesto, they have that agriculture needs reforms. Maybe they read my article or somebody else's articles. They ask for farm laws to be changed in their manifesto. Then the Punjab government, Aminder Singh, commissions Montek Singh Ahluwalia to write a whole report on what should be done about the farm sector. And he outlines the reforms, which are exactly what the Modi government proposed. What does the Congress party do now? They then, so their own government in Punjab has offered this. Their manifesto in 2019 has offered this. And they go ahead and get Greta Thunberg and Rihanna to say that farm laws are not needed. I mean, you know, I don't think the media, you guys, have done enough on this. How can that happen? And now these same guys are saying we need wealth redistribution. I mean, how does this happen? And then they worry that they are not getting votes. I mean,
so I do want to, you know, bring your get your thoughts in on affirmative action, which the Congress party is promising in its manifesto. And they say that is one form of wealth redistribution, reservations, according to your caste breakup, gender, and so on. In your analysis, do you find that issues like reservation still find still hold some sort of resonance with the Indian voter?
Look, I think I remember another article of mine where, which was done 6, 7, 8 years ago or something, that according that reservations will end. And I completely disagreed with the policy of reservations. I've never been for, I've always been for affirmative action. There's a big difference between reservations and affirmative action. So I said this will only end when everybody is reserved, every child, you know, every sex, every religion, every caste, there is a reservation for them. Okay. And we are practically there. So, you know, in Tamil Nadu, it's 60%. Okay. If you add the in university admissions, IIT admissions, etc., if you add all the reservations, it's up to 65-70%. This is, you know, not healthy. And I think the next big move in my hope is the next big move in India should be de-reservations and moving towards affirmative action. Affirmative action is needed. That's redistribution. Reservations is not.
I want to bring in your thoughts on what will happen in the South. We spoke just a little while ago on how Tamil Nadu played spoiled sport for the BJP during the India Shining campaign. But you are projecting a higher number of seats for the BJP in Tamil Nadu. What are you basing that on? What is that assessment based on?
I think that's pure. Look, as I mentioned it there weren't state elections in recently, but I think if ever there is a election on emotion, it was Tamil Nadu now. And what the opposition has done, or the ruling parties, the DMK. You know, even I, as a very old-fashioned liberal, find their comments on Hinduism staggering, staggeringly stupid, that a political party would do that. And in India, I mean, this is not somewhere. So I think they have fallen into a trap of their own making. Now, you know, Tamil Nadu has take languages, etc. we've always believed in a three language system, we continue to believe. So I don't know why they would take on, and you know, religion is an important part of Indian lives, and more than 80% of Indians are Hindu. Okay? Even the Sikhs, like me, have some Hindu connection and are very important. My mother was a Hindu, so very important Hindu connection. So I think they just misread it or whatever. So I think it's the emotion that they have unleashed, which will hurt them. And our analysis of, you know, this is not so much based on data. It's everything else in the book is on data. But this forecast is based on emotion. And I think, you know, something 3-5+ seats that the BJP gains when they have been nowhere. So that's what it is based on. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. But I think...
And your outlook on the India Alliance, which are the political parties that seem to have benefited the most and that seem to have really, you know, been given the rough end of the stick by being in this India Alliance?
Yeah, yeah. You know, this was a serious bit of analysis as to will the India, I mean, it seemed like a very, very sensible thing for the opposition to do, okay, if they had executed it properly. We know that the BJP vote share was 37% odd, 38% on its own in the 2019. So, the, you know, 62% are not voting for the BJP. So isn't it a very good idea that instead of five people contesting against, you know, the BJP, and everybody knows about the first past the post system, that wouldn't be a terribly good idea if only one person stood, and you know, you would increase. So it made a lot of logical sense. Now, what we find is that in our analysis, and there's a very simple way you could do it, you find out how much votes each party got in that state, how many seats did it win number one position, how many seats number two, the way. Simple, straightforward, objective formulas can be constructed, can be done. This has been done in other countries.
Sure.
So what that would mean, so we wanted to see how well they have followed the principle of either we sink together or we fly together.
Right.
What we found out was that there are two parties stood to gain the most from the India Alliance. And two parties that stood to lose the most from the Alliance, the way it was constructed, the way it was handled. The two parties that stood to gain the most were Congress and AAP. The two parties that, and this is in the book, this is not, the two parties that stood to lose the most was JDU, and Mamta. Now, I think one of the biggest success of the book is that it says this up front. And so this, so what has happened? JDU is no longer part of the alliance, and Mamta is fighting all the seats on her own.
That's right.
You know, so look, I really... So I think if any of my forecast is right, our forecast is right, then this would be, this has already been, you know, scored a six or scored whatever. Already right. Already 65% of the forecast is correct.
Right. And for the India Alliance, you're projecting even a 7% increase in India vote share gets it to only 207 seats, 65 seats short of a majority, and even two less than what Manmohan Singh won for the Congress in 2009 alone.
That's how bleak it is for the Alliance. But, and for them to keep, I mean, they know these numbers. right? They can do these calculations. They have enough smart people there.
Right.
So rather than worrying about how we redistribute wealth, they should have been worrying about how do we maximize our the alliance victory.
So are you expecting them to perform as they did in 2019, or do you see a decline?
Look,
or do you see them getting better?
No. One, there are two or three mathematical calculations that I'm very proud of in this book, which were a lesson to me, opened my eyes even further. One is, you know, India has been through, and Congress has been through, and we have been through some 70 odd years of elections. So we looked at the share of the Congress party votes. Okay, we've had the first past the post, some alliance, some not alliance, Nehru not there, this, that. And what you find is there is a consistent five, and you know, we present the data and a very, very narrow fit, very, very sharp fit of data forecast versus actual. And the forecast is based on that the result is that the Congress party has lost about 2 percentage points in votes since 1952.
Okay.
According to that, and that's what I'm going to go on, my co-author, Abhinav, is that they should get somewhere around 17% in this election. So it should be less than what they got in 2014.
Right.
So, but that's laid out very
clearly. Less than what they got in 2014, but a little more than what they got in 2019.
Yes. So 2019, they got 54 seats, or somewhere around there, and it was in the 40s, mid-40s, I forget the exact number. But
in 2014,
they should get less than, according to the vote share, they should get less than what they got in 2014, the Congress, on its own.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Bhalla, for a very thorough analysis on the issues that are dominating the minds of the voters. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Bhalla is in one of India's foremost sophologists who's also traveled across the country. Like he mentioned, he'd gone to Karnataka during Karnataka polls. So not only does he use data, but he also uses on-ground conversations to come to an analysis that seems very, very credible. Of course, we will only know whether Dr. Bhalla's predictions or projections of 334 seats or 347 seats for the BJP alone come true, and how the Congress party, whether the Congress party will be able to increase its vote share, increase its number of seats, if at all. Thank you so much, Dr. Bhalla, for that analysis. We wish, we'll of course wait, we'll all have the results in the first week of June. So until then, we can, until then, we can only rely on data and analysis. And one of the key takeaways from this conversation is that the Indian voter has evolved from caste and religion and is clearly voting on how his or her life has become better. And that's a very important takeaway that has come out. So just quoting Dr. Bhalla, it comes down to the economy. He says it's the economy, stupid. And that is what the Indian voter is voting on this election season of 2024. Thanks so much, Dr. Bhalla, for joining us on Money Control. Of course, we'll keep tracking all the big policies and politics and economics that are shaping India right here on this podcast, Political Economy with Shweta Bhunj. Thanks so much for watching, and thanks so much for listening in. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.